Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. Alex and I are bouncing off the walls because we have an awesome guest for you guys. Who have we got, Alex?
This is brilliant. And if we don't know, because we've already been on the phone for half an hour. It's Emma! Yay! And the summer hack! Oh, we miss her so much because Emma's been poorly. And
I've missed you.
We've missed you so bad.
But I'm back now.
You are, because your book is out.
Yeah, my book is out. Yeah.
How many fucks did you get put down to in the end by the editor?
But in the English edition, the UK and Australian edition, I think there's 54, and it went down to 19 for the Americans.
Ugh.
What?
Oh, censorship. Don't like it. Elena, what is the book?
Oh, so the book is called, ladies and gentlemen, make sure you go and buy it because I've read it. It's awesome. I love it. I've also pre-ordered a copy for my best mate, who will get it by tomorrow, by the way, even though we're pre-recording this. So this is not, you know, breaking any sort of like, oh my God. Anyway, so the book is called A Fatal Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, Murder in Ancient Rome. So we're going to be talking about murder. Yay!
Yay!
Yay! Because we've wanted to talk about this for ages, but we didn't want to annoy your publishers by before it was actually buy-worthy. But now it is buy-worthy and doing really well and getting only positive reviews online. We're going to talk all about it. Before we start, Alina wants to share something with the room and everyone
so
else.
So I purposely haven't told this anecdote to Alex because I know she's going to laugh at me. So it's to do with, we could have talked about Caesar. I know everybody wants to talk about his assassination, but do you know what? It's a whole different separate podcast. Want to learn something different, something new, some really cool stuff that Emma's put into the podcast. Anyway, so a couple of years ago, I went and had my blood taken just after the Ides of March. And as the nurse was sticking me with a needle, I was like, well, too bad it's not the Ides of March. It could be stabbing me. And she looked at me with this blank expression on her face. I was like, wow, that's an epic fail.
Oh, you are such a nerd.
She probably went home and was like, I had this bizarre person today who was wanging on the date.
But she didn't know what the Ides of March were, and she didn't get the stabbing joke, so never mind.
Did you have to explain it to her, or did you just back out of the room like a loser?
I couldn't back out the room. I had a needle stuck in my arm. So I tried to save myself just a little bit, but it didn't work. Never mind. Moving on.
Anyway, murder.
Not that you're dwelling on it, right?
Yeah, not that you're, like, not going to let it go. It's unlike you to hold a grudge, she says. Laughing. Grudges are what me and Alina do best. Okay, define murder for us. So under Roman law, Emma, what do they class as murder? And does it change at all between the Republic and the Empire?
Under Roman law, they do not class a lot as murder. They are spectacularly uninterested in people killing people in the streets or in their homes or in their private lives. They're only really interested if you have killed somebody who happens to be a politician or very famous for some reason. So for almost all of Republican Roman history, up until Sulla becomes dictator in the 80s BCE, there is nothing which says that murder is illegal or that you shouldn't do it according to the state, basically. It is technically not a crime for a lot of Roman history. And then Sulla comes in the 80s and gets made dictator in order to put an end to the civil wars that he started. Because he's good like that.
What a chap.
Yeah. And he introduces what is called the first murder law. But it is very, very specific. And it is basically says you're not allowed to bribe a jury or bribe a judge to pass a penalty of death. You're not allowed to try to interfere with a trial in any way that might end up with someone being executed as a result. You're not allowed to poison people, and you're not allowed to stab people in the street or go walking around in the street with a knife with the intention to harm somebody. So very specific things that they are legislating against, and it's basically because there's been almost 100 years of civil war and people are taking out their recriminations on one another in the street, basically.
There's so many jokes I could make about Croydon right now. Let's move on.
It basically is like as well as sort of gang warfare, because they had this war between Marius and Sulla that went on for a really long time, and then Marius died, but the war still went on, and Sulla eventually won, but everybody in Rome, everyone who was important in Rome, had taken a side, basically, and everybody had a generation's worth of, or a decade's worth of kind of gripes and grudges to hold against people on the other side, that they were then using the law courts and sneaky ways to get their revenge against each other, and then going backwards and forwards, essentially. And it was kind of making Rome a difficult place to live in. So he introduces this law to legislate against very specific types of violence. And then that's basically it. It's not really ever officially, there's never a law that's like in the way that there is in modern law, in like British law or American law, that says you are not allowed to kill somebody ever. If you as an individual kill another individual, then you will be punished for it. And that is broad and applicable to various circumstances. They're only ever very specific. And then later on, as you get into the imperial period, where it becomes more important that the state has, or the government has power over life and death, and that other people don't. That's when you start getting individual laws that are like, don't kill people who you have enslaved willy-nilly. Don't try to kill each other. Like, more, but again, they're kind of piecemeal bits and pieces. There is never until the Christian period, when you get to Constantine, which is way late. And
then you've got thou shall not kill.
Yeah, and you start to get, like, Constantine introduces the first law, which specifically says you're not allowed to kill enslaved people. And it does go on for about a page of ways in which you're not allowed to kill people.
A whole page.
It's really long. Like, in a way that suggests he was having quite a good time writing it down. It's like, don't throw them off of a cliff. Don't throw them out of a building. Don't beat them to death. Don't set them on fire. Don't stab them. And it just keeps going. Like,
this is like brilliant scope for turning up in court and going, but actually, see, what I did was kill him by basically paper cutting him to death, and that's not on your list, so you can't do it for it.
Do you think we could do a podcast of just you reading this whole list?
I mean, technically, it probably wouldn't be that long, but yeah. You might get a bit bored after a while. Also do the really good, there's a really good law which sometimes gets brought up as a murder law, which is about, is really a property damage law. But in there it has loads and loads of examples of ways in which an enslaved person could be killed, and whether or not the person who killed them would have to pay compensation. So it's got all kinds of things like, if you were a person, if you were an enslaved person and you were being shaved at a barber's by the side of the road, and across the road someone was playing with a ball, and then they got knocked over by a cart, and that cart meant that they knocked the ball, and the ball hit the barber, and then the barber cut the person's throat. Who's responsible?
I'm just going to do what all other Chelsea fans do and blame Torres.
It's almost certainly him.
Yes, almost certainly Fernando Torres' fault. So there's plenty of scope then, isn't there, for you to find, clearly.
Yeah.
Ancient Rome. Alina, you already said you don't want to do like Julius Caesar on this, do you? You want to focus on new exciting stuff.
Yeah, so actually Emma writes in her book that she's got a favourite Roman. I think Linda's going to love this part, because you're going to talk to us about Cicero, but it's not Cicero. So first of all, tell us, who was Publius?
We all knew it was coming.
Sorry. Never mind. Anyway, moving on. Clodius Pulcher.
So, Clodius Pulcher is one of my top favourite Romans. He is a horrible person in every way. And I have this real thing where I really like Romans that are horrible.
Yeah, just embrace the full.
Yeah, they just really go, like, people who really, like, people who I would hate in real life, I love them in the past. And he just really embraces chaos. Anyone who loves Cicero will hate Clodius, because he's kind of Clodius's great enemy. He's Cicero's great enemy. Sorry, they have this enormous falling out. The reason that they have this falling out is that Clodius decides that he wants to find out what happens in this women's only religious ceremony, the ceremony of the Bona Dei, which is like only women are allowed to go, and it's held in the...
Did you just say the words Bona Dei?
Bona Dei, yeah.
Alex, get your mind out of the gutter.
You can shut up, man. Twitter's on fire with you and the bees and the scrotums with the ancient Greece thing every week.
Oops.
He decides that he wants to find out what's going on in there. And so he very poorly disguises himself as a woman and breaks into the home of the wife of the head priest, who is Julius Caesar. So he breaks into Julius Caesar's house.
Basically doing Little Britain, like, I'm a lady! Really badly.
About as convincing as a 1970s, like, British comedian on the BBC. But my Julius Caesar's house is massive, so he gets lost in it really quickly, and then is found by some staff who immediately are like, are you Publius Clodius Vulture? So he never finds out what happens. Instead, he causes a massive scandal because he's done something terrible, broken into someone's house, and he has attempted to infiltrate a very sacred and important rite. He's taken to court for, lewd behaviour and scandalous behaviour. And his defence is basically, like, the full Shaggy defence, which is, it wasn't me.
It wasn't me.
Like, that's his entire defense, is just, it wasn't me. And he says, it can't have possibly been me, because I wasn't even in Rome at the time. I was somewhere else doing much more exciting things. And Cicero comes forward and says, it definitely was him, because he definitely was in Rome, because I saw him at dinner that night. And that destroys his defense. And then
Cicero's a bastard.
Although, to be fair, it seems like it was a rubbish defense in the first place.
Clodius, rubbish defence does not necessarily mean that you won't totally get away with it in Rome. Like, reading Roman trial anecdotes.
Basically, like, everyone's Trump.
Yeah, it's so stressful because everyone's like, well, you definitely did do it and you are awful in every way, but we like your dad, so okay. found guilty, and everything is very terrible. He also does just deranged things, like his original name is Publius Claudius Vulture, he was born as a member of this kind of very, very, very aristocratic, ancient, old money family who have lots and lots of notoriety and are very, very famous. But what that means is that he can't hold one job. There's one job that he can't have in the entirety of the Roman government. So obviously that's the job he wants. So he gets himself adopted by a plebeian family, and gives up his noble patrician name so that he can become tribune of the plebs, basically because he's like a full populist leader who kind of ramps up the people against the nobility. And he gives up his nobility, which is considered to be genuinely shocking, and becomes Clodius instead of Claudius. which is not a massive change. But
So, your favourite Roman then, how does he die? I'm assuming he gets murdered.
He does get horribly murdered. So he loves to cause a fight. He loves a fight, and he's a real antagonist of everybody. And he's against Cicero for a really long time. He like burns Cicero's house down and introduces a law specifically to get Cicero exiled. Which again,
so many people I'd like to get exiled at least.
Yeah, it's like he's so furious at Cicero that he gets himself adopted so he can become Tribune of the Plebs and he can introduce laws in order to specifically, that are specifically aimed at Cicero. So he does all that, and then as part of his kind of populist campaign, what he does is he starts his own paramilitary. And once he's got one, everybody wants one. So then there's this guy called Milo, who is famous only really for having constant fights with Clodius, who also starts his own little paramilitary. And they're these big armed gangs of men and gladiators who act in the interests of the person who is paying them. So they are like a personal mini army, essentially. And they're constantly having fights and beating up random bystanders and causing havoc. And one day one is going into the city of Rome and one is going out of the city of Rome, and they meet on the street, and have a wee bit of a, like, what are you looking at? Do you just look at me? What are you looking at? Kind of fight, like they always do.
Oh, I had that yesterday in Cambridge with an idiot cyclist trying to ride along and
yeah,
phone. Again. Was not, but not looking where you're going, no helmet on, in the middle of the road, reading your phone, riding with one hand, and then when you toot them, yeah, it does all that. I'm like, well, let me tell you something about how I don't have a problem, because if you run over, the world will be a better place. But anyway, back to...
Imagine if, like, that woman also worked with you and had, like, 50 people that had massive swords and clubs and things. And you also have massive swords and clubs and things, and the two of you are constantly running into each other at your place of work and also on the street.
Sounds like me and Alex a little bit.
So what happens is they have a kind of very very standard, like, yeah, all right, like, kind of clash, where people kind of shake their swords at each other, but it gets a bit out of hand, and one of Milo's gladiators stabs Clodius in the back, which is a massive escalation of what has occurred previously, because it was normally, like, 4 people dying, not 50 people dying, which people aren't really supposed to die. And Milo kind of panics when he hears what has happened, and he thinks, if I get pulled up in court on the basis that I, like, one of my gladiators, so basically me, has assaulted Clodius, then I'm definitely going to lose. But if I kill him, then I reckon there's a chance I'll get away with it.
Brilliant logic.
Like, it's one less witness, basically. So he has Clodius stabbed to death and left by the side of the road. Where another senator finds him riding back into Rome, and is like, oh shit, and takes his body into Rome, where the people are absolutely up in arms, because the main thing that Clodius did during his lifetime was introduce the corn dole. So he was the person who introduced the fact that every single person in Rome, got an amount of corn a day, which meant that they had bread every day, which meant that nobody ever had to be hungry again.
Okay.
So he's basically, he is the person who brought in the end of starvation in the city of Rome, essentially.
He did something good, didn't he?
He did, yeah. Not necessarily out of the goodness of his heart, but he did do that very good thing. And he was beloved amongst... He was not beloved amongst senators who thought that this was terrible. But amongst the people who he had helped, he was beloved for that reason. So they took his body to the Roman Forum, the main one, and laid it out in front of the Senate House, and then set a pyre. They cremated bodies, so they set his pyre using benches from the Senate House and burnt the Senate House down.
Okay, that's possibly a slight overreaction.
Possibly, but it is quite a big deal that one guy killed another guy, and killed him specifically. Like, he was, like, they really loved him quite a lot. And he was, like, to them, and to people who aren't in the like the circles of Roman gentry and aristocracy. He is this hilarious lad who is constantly doing comedy stuff and annoying Cicero, which is funny.
Anyone that annoys Cicero is amazing in my books.
Exactly. And I feel the sort of the same way, because there's something about Cicero that makes you really want to bully him.
Let's talk more about everyday people and get out of that like little mad world of senators and stuff. Let's talk about more generally, like fathers killing their children, because you've got some seriously disturbing yet interesting accounts in
here. I do. That's because there's this whole thing that Roman fathers had the right to kill their children, and if you open any like book for a general audience or children on that kind of on Romans, then that always comes up that they have the power of life and death over their children.
Some kids around here could do with that.
So I kind of looked into it, and they're like, the reason that you find that is because you've got loads and loads of examples from like the Roman distant past. So Romans writing about their own distant past, saying, look at all these people who sacrificed their sons basically because their sons were badly behaved. So the idea is, if your son or your child somehow offends you or the state in some way, then you can honor kill them, essentially. It's basically what it is. No one ever says this for some reason, but it's effectively an honor killing. Like, in order to protect the honor of your family, you can kill your kid. And so you get these examples. Like, there's this very famous one with a girl who is, she's kind of 13, 14 years old, and one of her dad's friends takes this real liking to her and wants to marry her, and he says no. So he comes up with this amazing plan, which is that he will accuse her of being a runaway slave, and then he will take her into his household, and then he will have her that way, essentially. So she's on, like, pootling along on her way to school, and these guys come out and they're like, this girl is my slave, she belongs to me, she's runaway, she's mine, and make a big fuss, and she gets snatched off the streets. And then there's a whole court case about it. And apparently no one has any bits of paper, because no one can prove either way. And it ends up being ruled that this wee girl is in fact a runaway slave and is going to be taken home by this guy who is going to rape her and destroy her honor. And she's going to be forced to live as his sex slave, effectively. So her dad stands up and stabs her, and says that he would rather have a dead daughter than a dishonored daughter.
Is there no appeal process first?
Basically the whole story is like told in the sense that it's incredibly admirable what he did, that he would protect his family and protect her honor over protecting her life, and that the family as a kind of facet of Romanness is much more important than anything else. And you get, have kind of loads and loads of examples right the way back to Brutus, who threw out the kings, the original kings, and forced them out of Rome, but they weren't executed, they were just exiled. And Brutus became the first consul, and there was this kind of, there were occasional kind of rumblings of people who wanted to bring the kings back, because there's always someone who's conservative. And one of those people were Brutus's own sons, who were conspiring to bring the kings back and reinstate the monarchy. So Brutus had them flogged to death in front of him, and like his whole public kind of flogging to death. And there's loads of these stories of fathers basically killing their children in order to protect their honor, or because their children, their adult children, they're always adult or above adult, or like, you know, teenage, kind of killing them in order to protect their honor or to protect the honor of the state in some way. Or if there's army generals, there's this army general who kills his son, who is an absolute maniac. His son is amazing. He does this thing where he Somebody is threatening to prosecute his dad because his dad is not giving the son a good enough career, basically. And so the son rides off in the middle of the night, breaks into these people's home, and threatens them until they agree to drop the lawsuit. And that is
told. Don't tell me the dad then kills him for honour.
Later then does kill him because they then go to war with the Gauls, and there's this whole thing with an oracle, a prophecy that there can't be any one-on-one fighting until the battle or else it'll be bad luck. But the son gets into a one-on-one battle with a Gaul who is taunting him for like having shit hair or something. And he rides back to his dad, who is the general, and says, look what I did, I killed a Gaul, aren't I great? And his dad says, no, I literally told you one thing, don't kill a Gaul, and then has him executed.
You know, I've got to tell you, you've got so much humour in this book, and I'd sat there and laughed, but this whole part of killing kids was actually really horrific. Some of the things people were doing were just you've got to go read the book, guys, because then you'll be just as horrified as I was.
The killing kids bit, especially the killing babies, because infanticide is something that always comes up. Because, again, when people say, like, they're allowed to kill their children, what people imagine is not them killing their adult children, but people killing their infant children. And you have all these examples that people bring up. I was talking to a friend of mine, actually, yesterday, who has a one-year-old. And he said that that bit really upset him because there's a bit where I say babies are fragile and centuries are long. because basically there is this English estate where 90 infant bodies were found, Roman infant bodies. And a bunch of archaeologists, because you can't really trust them very much, started going around saying that this house was a brothel and that all of these infants had been killed in order because they were too, because this was a brothel and sex workers didn't want the babies. But this place had been inhabited for nearly 600 years as a house, and this is a place where infant mortality is like 1 in 3. It's like the infant mortality rate is incredibly high. And there are, you know, over 600 years in a place without antibiotics and where they had
cesareans and
in a place where they believe that, you know, their medical textbooks told them that women's wombs went wandering around the body looking for moisture if they weren't kept damp enough.
Let me guess, did a man say this and they had to be kept damp by sperm?
My God, I can't believe you guessed it.
why am I not surprised?
This has come up before.
Yeah, it has. So don't you remember the flying vaginas, the South American flying vaginas?
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, so do you have any instances of women killing their children?
You do, and they are more realistic because all of the ones of men killing their children are mythological, basically.
Okay.
So far in the past, and they're written in terms of like, look at our glorious ancestors, why can't we be that good? Essentially, like, now everyone's soft and loves their children, it's like wankers. But you do have women who kill their children. There's a very famous one from the second century called Pontia, who we mostly know about because she turns up in lots of poems, and she's used as an example in loads of poems by Martial and Juvenal and satirists as like, I'd rather eat at Pontia's dinner table than do whatever with you.
Okay.
Considered to be a hilarious joke. And far as we can tell, she killed her children for reasons that nobody knows, but she poisoned them. And was that like, then it was some kind of massive trial. But she's like quite obscure in terms of what she actually did. People have made up stuff for her because she appears so often. So there's like lots of very fictional examples of her life, including one from the 15th century, actually. Someone in 15th century Spain, for absolutely no reason at all, got a bit of stone and carved her a fake tombstone.
Okay.
With a whole life story on it, in Latin. That is, what gives it away is that the Latin is too good. But it has this whole mad life story. It doesn't make any sense. And then there's like fourth century scholiasts made up little stories for her as well. Like, it's really, it's quite sweet that everybody wanted to know about her. But but she definitely killed her children, and it was a scandal and a half at the time. And people were shocked and appalled. And you have this woman in Smyrna who is never named, but she causes a scandal because she murders her own son. But she murders her son because he killed her other child from her previous marriage. And this causes a problem because she had therefore committed a revenge killing, which is fine, and you're allowed to do that, and is in fact strongly encouraged, well, no, not strongly encouraged, but encouraged. But also she had killed her child, and that is very bad, and you can't go around saying that that's okay. So it causes this, like, the entire Roman system to come to a halt, and the governor who's hearing it is this guy called Dolabella, and he doesn't know what to do, because if he prosecutes her for murder or finds her guilty of, like, homicide of any kind, then he would be saying that revenge, like, in certain circumstances you can't do a revenge killing, and he can't be doing that. But if he says it's okay, then he'd be saying in certain circumstances you can kill your children, and he can't do that. So it's like this paradox. So what he does is he sends it to the Areopagus, which is this very, very ancient Greek court, who meet on a extremely uncomfortable hill. It's not even really a hill, it's like a big rock that's deeply uncomfortable to sit on. There's like 12 of them, and they're Athenian elders, and they sit and they listen and they go, right, we don't want to piss off the Romans, so we can't disagree with them. Every decision is disagreeing with the Romans.
Okay.
So what we're going to do is just take a recess for a little while and think about the matter, and then we'll come back in a bit. We're going to come back in a century. So in 100 years, we'll see you here, and we'll give you our decision then. And then that's the end of the situation.
I was going to say, if life is cheap for Romans, and it's still not okay for women to kill their kids, that's
no, but it's not really
unnatural.
Okay. Yeah, it is. Like, life is cheap in certain circumstances, and it's mostly cheap depending on how much it means to other people. So from a societal perspective, the only lives that mean anything are lives which have both dignitas and fama, so like a reputation and some importance in the community. So if you're a consul, or if you're the son of a consul, or if you have any kind of government job, you're a pontifex or whatever, then you have an importance to the wider community that is beyond just yourself. And mm-hmm. those lives have weight and meaning, and it causes ripples in the kind of political structure. And those are the ones you tend to see in the writing that survived. But ones which only cause trauma at a kind of personal level in the family are very, very private. And you just don't really see those at all. It has to be something like this, where it causes a genuine problem, that, like, her killing her son, who is an adult, is a problem. But it wouldn't be written down in any circumstance if it wasn't for the fact that he had killed her other son. Mm. And the fact that he had killed her other son wouldn't have ever been written down if it wasn't the fact that she then revenge killed him. Like, yeah. That is the bit that caused the problem. And those bits are rare enough that they cause a bit of a ripple that we see them. But the ones that are kind of personally upsetting or which cause trouble in families are so private that they just don't get written down. So we very rarely get to see them. We only get to see kind of outliers.
So let's stick with that idea that, you know, they're not written down, because you mentioned in your book that it's actually rare to read in ancient sources about domestic violence killings. Mm. But you have two absolutely amazing examples, one which is about Regilia, if I've pronounced her correctly. Mm-hmm. So tell us more about her and what happens to her, because it actually involves someone we have all heard of, doesn't it?
It does. Even if you don't think you've heard of him, everyone knows who he is. So Regilla, or Regilla, or Regillian, is the wife of a guy called Herodes Atticus, who's not the world's most famous name, but he built the big theatre that looks very beautiful and very well preserved on the side of the, what's it called? Oh my God, I'm having a total blank. Big hill in Athens.
The Acropolis.
Thank you very much. Oh my god, I was thinking Parthenon and I cannot think of what it was on.
It's only because I saw it on a World War One caption because they were looking at it from an artillery position. It's not because I'm smart.
By the way, Alex, well done bringing in World War One into ancient history. Yeah.
Boom.
No
There's
way.
Some Greek can't. Soldiers staring at it.
So there is. You have the Acropolis and everything is kind of ruined except for one very well preserved theatre on the side where they filmed a Nescafe advert a couple of years ago. And that theatre is very well preserved because it's not ancient Greek, it's ancient Roman. It was built by Herodes Atticus in order, in remembrance of his wife Regilla, who he had beaten to death while she was pregnant.
What a nice chap. It's almost like the Taj Mahal story.
A bit, yeah. He's rubbish. He is someone who punched an emperor. That's how, like, notoriously violent he is. Like, he straight up punched Antoninus Pius on the top of a hill because they got into an argument. But he is a very, very famous and very, very, very rich Greek Roman, Greco-Roman, so he is from an ancient Athenian family. He also has these kind of Roman connections that go back. He manages to marry into the Claudian family through some ancestors, and he marries, when he's in his late 40s, he marries a 14-year-old girl from a patrician family called Regilla, and whisks her off to Rome and basically keeps her pregnant for her entire life. She has a lot of babies in a 10-year period. And then one day she annoys him somehow, so he gets his kind of sidekick, right-hand man guy, to punish her by beating her because he can't even be bothered to beat his own wife, and he accidentally beats her to death. Which again would be a kind of fairly private affair. It's not something that would be written down in stories necessarily, except that Herodes is a philosopher, and also this causes he gets pulled into court because Regilla comes from a very old and very famous patrician family, and her brother is not about to take the fact that his sister has been beaten to death lying down. Like, that's just really offensive to him. So he drags Herodes off to court and tries to prosecute him. Unfortunately, Herodes is a trained and very talented orator and philosopher and public speaker, and Regilla's brother is a rubbisher. And his entire prosecution is, look how old my family is, and he basically gives his, like, family tree. And Herodes stands up and gives a great speech, and everybody goes, oh, yes, well done, well done. And he goes off scot-free.
We like the brother for trying, though.
He did do it. He did try. He just wasn't particularly... He would have been better off hiring a prosecutor, but he decided to do it himself. And his entire thing is basically, look, my family is very ancient. My sister is dead. He did it. Punish him. And Herodes' argument is, I didn't kick her. My freedman kicked her, therefore not me.
That's so horrible.
Yeah, it is. And they're like, yeah, fair enough. But it is, and then Herodes goes off and builds loads and loads. He likes building monuments to people that he that die in suspicious circumstances around him. He has a boyfriend who dies, who he also builds loads and loads of statues to, and buildings, but he builds a lot of things, including that, which is called the Theatre of Herodes Atticus, not the Theatre of Regilla.
He's not really doing it for her, is he?
Weirdly enough, he put his own name on it, but...
I'm going to put him firmly in the dick category.
He's one of those ones who's not even, like, fun, horrible. He's just quite horrible. There's a story about his son not being able to read or not learning his alphabet properly. So Herodes buys, I can't remember how many letters there are in the Greek alphabet, but say 28 boys, and names them all letters of the alphabet, and then has them hang out with his son so his son will learn their names. so that he will then learn his alphabet. That's the kind of person that Herodes is.
Why didn't you use him as an example for our down the pub?
Because Caesar's worse.
It's true. He didn't genocide a million people. So.
Yeah, this is true. Livia Agrippina, the younger, and Quarta Hostilla, or Hostilia, what do all of these women have in common?
They are all accused of murdering their husband.
At this point in Roman history, good on him.
Yeah.
What are you telling us?
I believe that Agrippina definitely did murder her husband. I feel like I'm pretty confident in that. Livia, I don't think did. So Livia is the wife of Augustus, the first emperor. And she is considered to be slightly too bossy for her own good by some historians. And so there are stories that, it's quite good actually, there's stories that she killed Augustus and she got around it by painting figs on a tree with poison so she could get around his tasters, and then he would pull the fruit off the tree. And obviously it couldn't be poisoned because it comes directly from the tree, and eat it, and it poisoned him.
But he was old at this point, though, wasn't he? He just died of old age.
Also in his 80s, and had lived a very hard life of, like, 20 years of war, and then 40 years of running an empire. And you'd think that, and, you know, again, a place where we have no, and, you know, 80s is good in a place with no medicine. but you'd think that would be good enough, but no, there was a woman around, so... also, people you like to accuse Livia of things as a way of casting aspersion on Augustus, basically. Like, you can't really cast aspersion on him directly, but if you say his wife was horrible, then it suggests that maybe he was horrible too.
Is it harder for a woman to get away with murdering her husband than anything else in ancient Rome?
Probably. Certainly any kind of high profile man who suddenly drops dead, I suspect that people are going to look at the wife, or even if they go a bit funny because they have magic, they believe quite strongly in magic and witchcraft and things and curses, so there are lots of accusations of people cursing the husbands, but certainly anyone high profile enough, and you don't get more high profile than Augustus and Livia. It helps that it was Livia's son who becomes emperor next. Tiberius is not related by blood to Augustus. He is adopted, and he is Livia's son from her first marriage. And so the theory goes that Livia murdered him so that she could put her son on the throne. She could have waited 6 months and he'd have dropped it by himself.
But... yeah, I'd be looking at him going, oh, how has he woken up again this morning? As it is, it wouldn't have needed to push it along, would you?
But apparently she was impatient, and thought that he might...
well, maybe her womb was all dry and stuff, and she just lost it.
Maybe it had gone wandering around.
Yeah, maybe.
Impeded
her judgment.
And Quartia Hostilia is a Republican era, wife of a consul, who, similar story, actually, her husband... she is very interested in her son's career, and she wants her son to become consul. And so she kind of is paying for him, and she's trying to run his campaigns and helping him along, but he fails several times in a row. But her husband succeeds in the election. Her ideal is basically for her husband and her son to be consuls together, because that would be like the ultimate prestige for the family. Mm. But he fails, and she's very disappointed in him. And then mysteriously her husband drops dead a couple of months later. And as kind of second place, or like next in line, her son gets his position, and everybody goes around saying that she murdered her husband so that her son could get a better job.
Oh dear.
So we've got two questions. I'm going to chuck both questions just to confuse you, make life just more difficult for you.
Sure.
Just for fun. So are there any examples of slaves killing their enslavers, or vice versa? How common is it for enslavers to kill their slaves?
All right. Very common for enslavers to kill enslaved people. Mm-hmm. Like distressingly so. And you, what you see in law, for example, is the occasional law which makes it more difficult for them to do so, or which says, can you, like, the, like, first one you get is one that says, can you not, you're no longer allowed to just send your enslaved members of your household that you don't like anymore off to be eaten by wild animals in the arena or as food just because you're fed up with them and with no oversight. There's no oversight.
Well, because there's a crossover, isn't there? Because essentially, I mean, it's awful, but they're property. This is property law, this not humanity.
It is fully property law, and it basically says, like, you can't just... And it's effectively regulating, like, how many people are going to turn up to be eaten that day. It basically says you can't just send them off for no good reason. I suspect because they were probably sending off, like, ill and elderly enslaved people, because there is another law during Claudius' reign which says stop dumping your ill and elderly enslaved people on Tiber Island, because people were just rowing out there, dumping them on the island, and then, like, abandoning dogs in the forest.
Yeah, it just reminds me, McGill University, their radio station, went across, they did this thing where they were crossing the border and punking Americans to try and make Americans look stupid. And one of the things they did was convince a load of people, allegedly on the Harvard campus, that they were doing a petition against the ancient Canadian right of floating off your old people on eaten by polar bears.
Oh my god!
I don't know how true this is.
I enjoy that. But this was an ancient Roman tradition of abandoning the enslaved members of your household who you bought and whose labour you extracted from them and who you are now going to dump to die on an island in the middle of Rome. But basically it says, like, you have to go to a praetor and make your case, and they will say yes or no. And then you get ones which, like, you're no longer allowed to deliberately beat enslaved people to death. If it happens by accident, I know everybody, you know, who hasn't accidentally beaten someone to death.
So the praetor could still give permission to dump Granny on the island?
Or send them off to the to be eaten in the arena, yeah.
Do you know what? I would be a granny collector in the Roman period.
You would. You'd have a house full of useless grannies.
Exactly.
That you could pick up and saved.
Exactly, because I feel so bad.
I like the idea, actually, that there might be, like,
a granny,
granny savers. Yeah, like a people...
Like a cat cafe, but with
grannies. Yeah. Basically, like, an old people's home.
Little old ladies who were stolen from their homeland in Gaul when they were 13 and have been forced to schlep about Rome being the enslaved property
we'll just
of
let
some
them
flat.
Drink coffee and eat pasta and...
Play with cats.
Great. Yeah. But yeah, so you get stuff like that, but you also get stuff like there's an inscription from a town just outside of Rome, which is an advert for like undertakers. And it's like, we will take your body and deal with it. And also, if you want, we can crucify your slaves for you.
Sorry.
I'm
sorry that I laughed.
This is like a man in a van.
Yeah, it is. It's like...
Man with a van.
It's like Craigslist for people who could come. It's like, it costs, like, you know, 2 denarii per person who has to help, basically, plus the cost of supplies, so depending on how good you want the nails to be. But yeah, so you can outsource the crucifixion of your enslaved people if you can't be asked to do it yourself.
Oh my god, that's so horrible.
Yeah,
what's wrong with these people?
So that is constant, and it's important to note that they do the crucifixion in the most populous parts of town as well. So, like, in the busiest intersections and the places where people are most likely to be, like, outside the gates, that's where the most crucified people will be, as a warning. Mm. On the other hand, people killing their enslavers is very rare because there is a law that comes in the imperial period, which says if one enslaved person kills their enslaver, then the entire household gets crucified.
Oh, okay.
A lot of the bigger houses have hundreds of enslaved people in every household. People own up, you know, the richest people own thousands of people. So there is a very famous case of a guy called Secundus who is murdered by one of the people he has enslaved. There's two theories given by Tacitus as to why it happens. One is that he had been promised that he would be freed, and then that had been taken back, which is a fair enough reason to kill somebody, I reckon. And the other suggestion, which Tacitus incidentally doesn't think that either of these are particularly good reasons to kill a senator, but he, the other suggestion he gives is that Secundus had a sex slave, a male sex slave, that the murderer had fallen in love with, and he was trying to save his the boy that he loved from being subjected to being Secundus's sex slave.
Pretty valid reason to off the guy, to be fair.
Both reasonably valid.
Systematic rape.
Yeah, systematic rape or being psychologically tortured with constant promises. Oh yeah, I'll free you, I'll free you, I'll free you, and then not. Either
going,
way.
Ha ha, not really.
Yeah. Either way, Secundus gets stabbed. And the, what happens is that the Senate says, okay, well now all 400 members of the household, in slavery, which includes like men, it's women, it's children of all ages, it's families, it's 400 people, have to be crucified. They're all going to be put to death. Because if we just let enslaved people kill their enslavers, then like, I don't know, like basically when they're talking to each other in the speeches that Tacitus writes out, he basically says, look, I've got hundreds of enslaved people at home. You've got hundreds of enslaved people at home. Everybody in this room has hundreds of enslaved people at home, not to mention all the ones on our estates. How comfortably are you going to sleep if you know that like this massive punishment isn't going to happen, basically? Like if you think that there's no big like no big deterrent, it's not just their life that they're going to give up, but it's the life of everyone in that house.
Well, presumably there's families of enslaved people under one roof as well. So
and children.
And children. And also there is a long argument that goes on about whether freed slaves. So when slaves are freed in Rome, they remain part of the household, and quite often they still live in the household. And they're still very connected. They take their enslaver's surname. And so there is a point at which freed people are going to be executed as well. And so basically the argument is, look, if we don't do this, then none of us can sleep safely in our beds, because we've all got hundreds of enslaved people who live in our houses and put our shoes on for us. So they go, okay, yeah, sure, no, you're right. And they take these 400 people to be executed. And the there's a riot, like the people of Rome, who do not own hundreds of slaves each, they riot and throw stones and throw things and try to rescue these people. And so that they have to give up on the first attempt. The second attempt, they bring in the army to basically surround the 400 people being crucified, and all of these men, women, and children, all 400 of them are lined up outside the gate of Rome and crucified. And that is what happens if you murder the person who enslaved you, basically.
And it's why it's rare.
It's why it's pretty rare to see. Because it is not, like, if you were just risking yourself, like, you could sacrifice yourself in order to save other people or potentially change something, but if you're sacrificing everyone you know, then like the Romans, when
they're tyrant, isn't it?
Yeah, when the Romans are cross about something, and largely they're cross about people going, hang on a minute, that's not very fair. Then they come, like, they don't just swat a fly, like they smash that fly into the ground with a sledgehammer. They do not fuck about when it comes to deterrence.
So Jesus. Alex managed to bring in a World War One reference. I want to bring in a World War Two reference. This is exactly what the Germans did to the Poles. You know, you're caught hiding, for example, Jew. Well, we're going to massacre the whole village. We're going to massacre your whole family.
Basically. Like everyone. And then, you know, it's a more effective deterrent, because if you're the kind of person who thinks about other people and might want to rescue another person, then you're the exact kind of person who's not going to want to risk the life of every single person you know.
Exactly.
So yeah, so it's pretty one-sided, to be honest, the Roman relationship to death and the people that they enslaved.
Emma, let's finish with something really weighty and academic. And that's really going to make people think seriously about this topic. Tell us about Locusta and how she fits into all of this. And what is this about a giraffe?
Oh, the giraffe. You know, when I was researching this, I got really obsessed with that giraffe.
Really?
Because I could not work out where it had come from. It took me just, like, bear in mind I have a full-time job, like, the evenings that I spent...
obsessing about the giraffe.
Trying to work out what the giraffe. So, Locusta is a very famous poisoner from the reigns of Claudius and Nero. And she is the woman, so she allegedly comes from Gaul, although no one knows if that's really true or not, but she allegedly comes from Gaul, and she was somehow came to the attention of the imperial family for doing some good poisoning in Gaul or something, no one really knows. But she is drafted by the imperial family to mix poisons that do what they want them to do. So the Romans are really into poisons that do all kinds of different things, like a poison that kills slowly so that it looks like natural disease is very highly prized, or a poison that kills very quickly so that no one has any time to do anything about it, or a poison that might send someone mad before they die. So they like, they're really into the kind of intricacies of poisoning someone. And apparently Locusta is very good at mixing up a poison that does what you want it to do. And she is the woman who is drafted, who's picked up by Agrippina in order to mix the poison to kill Claudius. The story going that Claudius was such a massive alcoholic and ate so much that he was impossible to poison because his metabolism just rejected poison.
Oh God.
Which I find really funny. And so she does manage to kill him. It takes two attempts because his metabolism does not work with the mushroom one. Like, the classic story is that the poison was sprinkled on a very good mushroom, but apparently that didn't work, and so they had to like double poison him. But everyone is so happy with that she's kept around, and she becomes Nero's like pet poisoner. She mixes the poison which kills his adopted brother and basically anybody else that he once got rid of. She mixes the poisons that attempts to get rid of Agrippina when Nero tries to kill her, and probably also is the person providing Agrippina with antidotes to her own poison. And she is about, and is a kind of, there's these stories of her running like poison schools. She's given like an estate and she gets to teach people how to mix good poisons.
Tell me she gets what's coming to her in the end.
Well, what happens is that, I mean, I always feel kind of bad for her, because it's not like she was there like sneaking poison into people's thing, into food for her own gratification.
It's just a job.
Yeah, it's a job. And
that's,
it's something,
a good job.
She can't say no to, because Nero does beat people to death on a fairly regular basis. And it's like either she does it or somebody else does it and she dies. She does have this reputation as like a deranged serial killer, like stalking the streets of Rome, poisoning people for her sexual pleasure. But really, she's just a poor woman who was living a life in Gaul, may or may not have killed somebody, and then got dragged to Rome in order to hang out with Nero, the least fun person ever.
Yeah. It's not the kind of gig you want, is it?
No. But she's kind of quite famous during her time, so when Nero falls, she is also executed. But there is a story, and if you Google her, it comes up, like, you get all of these, like, oh, Locusta, but I'm going to Google her now and tell you what comes up, but it comes up as, like, oh, the world's first serial killer, Locusta, killed all of these people, which is, like, the worst. And one of the stories that comes up is that she was fucked to death by a giraffe.
Sorry.
Having seen many giraffes trying to, like, even eat something near to the ground and how they just can't do it without, like, a hell of a lot of effort,
I've just googled her now, and we've got, like, there's the Wikipedia, and then the life and bizarre death of the necro entrepreneur Lacosta, which is a great sentence. How the world's first serial killer was raped to death by a giraffe, and, like, it just goes on and on and on. Was Lacosta really raped to death by a giraffe? She was not raped to death by a giraffe.
What? It's just physically, logistically not possible. I mean, like, seriously, if I've got a photo, I'll put it on Twitter of a giraffe trying to eat from a bush close to the ground, and it's hilarious. It's basically doing the splits and, like, trying to put how a giraffe would get down there to do her in the first place. I mean, someone would have to rig up a hell of a contraption to put her at the appropriate height. I mean,
I have an idea. Maybe.
We're going to launch a History Hack competition for people to figure it out.
Maybe somebody dressed up as a giraffe. Have you thought of that?
I hadn't thought of that. The Romans weren't massively into dressing up as things. But
where does this story come from?
The story comes from, I eventually tracked it down to, the first edition from the year 2000 of a book called The Encyclopedia of Serial Killers.
That's like, it's obviously not a first-hand account then.
No. published by that notoriously excellent publisher Facts on File, which I think might be self-published, to be honest. So eventually that's where I found, he just invented it. Just a man named Michael invented it and wrote it in a book, and everyone was like,
this seriously warped fucking mind. Michael, get help.
So that's where it comes from. She was not raped to death by a giraffe. She was just, like, executed in a more normal way. Admittedly, this was the Raven, so she was probably fed to something or beaten to death.
It would have been pleasant.
It wouldn't have been pleasant.
But it wouldn't have been incessant giraffe rape.
Yeah, which is pretty terrible.
Which is not a thing.
So, God bless her. She lived, like, a rubbish life being Nero's psychic and then was executed. And now, in the afterlife, she's remembered as a serial killer, which she wasn't. He was raped to death by a giraffe. Poor Lacosta.
This giraffe is so stoned that they...
Why a giraffe? That's...
I don't know, but it's like when you go... So if you go on safari, everyone's like, on the first day, you'll be like, oh, wow, it's a giraffe. On day two, you can tell the people that have been on site for a few months, they don't even stop for the giraffes anymore because they move so slow and they don't really do anything that interesting. They just eat. I can't imagine any giraffe summoning up enough energy to rape someone to death.
Oh my god.
They're basically like massive long-lived koalas. They're just, everything's like meh.
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 Yeah. I don't even, Michael Newton, whoever you are, where did you get this idea from?
Get help.
And why? And this is his great legacy. This is Michael Newton's great legacy, which is that he's managed to persuade everybody.
Emma, listen, thank you so much for joining us.
It's always my pleasure.
Oh, I love how highbrow this podcast is. Well, what's it, our new tagline? It was my tagline, but we're going to adopt it. So what did they say I did? Oh, reduces history to stupidity.
Yeah, history is stupidity. It's always stupid or horrible, and it's better to laugh at it.
So I did balls and bees, and now we're doing giraffe rope.
Yeah.
Even, I'd say, because Bertie can hear us, the cat has actually woken from his massive slumber and is looking at me like, fucking giraffe rape, what?
What are you doing?
Even my cat is not buying it, Michael Newton.
Guys, listen, you've got to go and get this book. I absolutely loved it. I laughed, cried. Felt a little bit depressed at the same time because some of the stuff is really horrible.
Where did you get the idea?
I'll tell you exactly what it was. I was talking to a friend of mine who is a history teacher in America, and it was the day that the Golden State Killer was caught, and we were talking about serial killers and true crime. And she was saying that she uses true crime to teach like 20th century and 18th century history to high school students because it's a really good way to get them involved. And I was like, oh my God, that's so good. I bet there's a really good book about Raymond murder. And I went looking to find a Roman true crime book, and after 2 days realised that there wasn't one, so I thought, well, I suppose I'll have to write it.
Best book, so when you go looking for it and one's done it, and you think, well, I'll just have to write it myself.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. What's it called?
It's called A Fatal Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum.
Buy it, preferably from Waterstones, because Emma works for them, or from an independent bookshop and not on online megaloops.
Feel free to leave me a 5-star review.
Absolutely. And if it arrives bent, don't leave her a shit review. That's nothing to do with the book.
No, it's not my fault. I'm sorry.
And also, if you, what was your favourite review for your Agrippina book? The idiot that was like...
I bought it for someone else. 1-star.
Like, why would you bother?
Not that I resent you, person, but...
Whoever you are, you're on a list with Michael Newton. Do you know what? I said, part of me, even if we don't circulate it, we've got to get Steve the cartoonist to do a cartoon of Michael Lee being raped to death by a giraffe.
Oh my god.
There, you know a giraffe is a giraffe is gonna feature on your cartoon for this one.
Oh no.
Brilliant. We're probably going to chat for quite some time yet because we have no lives and we're silly, but we'll call it a day for the podcast. Emma, we've already decided we want to do a trilogy with you about mad bastard Roman emperors. We need to do Caligula, Caesar and Nero.
Okay, fair.
And talk about how they're just insane. You up for it?
I'm up for it.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Join us tomorrow when Greg Valdespina will be with us to talk all about Senegal and France and colonialism. This was really good. So we started with World War One and we go all the way through as well. And we talk about peanuts and why they're so important. So if you want to know why peanuts are so important in the history of Senegal, then you're going to have to join us for that. And the cartoon will be explained thoroughly. We are now on YouTube. We are posting all of our new episodes on there and we have our own channel and we are gradually posting all of the back episodes because we have been made aware of the fact that you can only find the last 100 on some platforms. So you can go and listen to your heart's content and laugh at the cartoons and have a great time. One particularly great thing about it is that we have organised everything into categories. So if you just want to listen to all of our World War II shows, you can do so, or there's ancient history, or there's TV tie-ins. If you just have a hankering for famous people, so you can select what interests you the most and listen to it in one go. So do go over there and subscribe. Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so.